members of this council, or I guess they're members, they patrol Orvantan. And they are associate Transcendental Master Force organizers. And they're looking for evidence of the work of the primary force organizers. Apparently, they have to find it. Apparently, they aren't told about this. Because the paper tells us that 987 billion years ago, an inspector discovered that the fact that space conditions were favorable for energy materialization in what was then an easterly segment of Orvantan. Yes.
Was this inspector an associate yes. Transcendental Master yes. Force organizer?
Yes. Yes, and what he's discovering is the fact that his senior colleagues have been out here working for a long time, and the papers do not tell us how long they worked to produce a situation which could be discovered. Yes.
Bill, what did you say the Council of Equilibrium was composed of?
Associate Transcendental Master Force organizers. And they're based on Yversa. Yes, Helen.
The government of Orvantan, has that all been set up before?
Yes, this is all set up.
Well, is it set up before anything in Orvantan or anything in the superuniverse?
I don't think so. I think there was a time way back when the force organizers were working out here before the days of the Ancients of Days.
That's what I thought.
To all practical intents and purposes, the Ancients of Days arrived shortly after the force organizers began work, even though that may have been 1,000 trillions of years later.
They had a capital, though.
Yeah, I think
so
the first...
Spirit of Stardom.
They didn't come here until Yversa was built.
That was built.
And there had to be a lot going on here before Yversa was built. But I look at it this way, Helene. Let's say that my guess of the age of Orvantan is right. Let's say it's 50,000 trillions of years old. I would judge that the Ancients of Days maybe weren't here for the first couple trillion years, but I think they've been here for more than 95% of the history of Orvantan. I think there was a comparatively short time where the force organizers were here and they weren't, but ever since then, they've been here.
Now, Bill, did the force organizers build this architectural
wheel? Don't ask me how Yversa got built. This is getting real tricky, because I think it was built with the power centers. But we haven't even got the power centers on the picture yet. I think a lot of things went on, and then I think the power centers came out and built Yversa. Then I think the Ancients of Days came out. We're back in the dawn of time now.
Is there any difference between master force organizers and just plain force organizers?
The term force organizers connotes either of the two orders. But if you want to be technical, or master force organizers, I think, could connote either of the two orders. If you want to be technical, you speak of primary eventuated master force organizers, which we've been talking about up until now, and their junior associates called associate transcendental master force organizers.
It tells us that they don't need energy regulators and power centers on Havona, but since the 7 super universes, they have them there,
yes.
One for every 1,000 worlds.
Right.
I thought about this, and I thought possibly that they projected these architectural spheres of the 7 super universes first, possibly from Havona.
I don't know.
And then had to go back there to keep things from getting bollocks, keeping too much voltage running around or something.
Well, put it this way, Havona, prior to the super universes, was an absolutely stable creation. Mm-hmm. But with energy fluctuations taking place out here, I think external mass could set up internal stresses in Havona. And I think it's the job of these power centers to compensate any such stresses. I think when this thing is pretty well done, if you can visualize that, then I think, again, they might be superfluous.
Mm-hmm.
But that'll never be.
But again, they will become more superfluous out here.
Yes, quite. Yes. This inspector went back to UVersa and reported. If we could put it in our language, he said, well, the boys have been at work again. We got a nebula to get set up. And they said, well, that's interesting. That's interesting. And so, 87 billion years later, they issued a permit. Yeah, a building permit. And they issued it to this inspector. And he assembled his crew, bulldozers, CBs, and whatnot, and they headed out for this area and took over. Now, what they did was they moved at right angles, some up and some down. They moved at right angles to the plane of the nebula that they wanted to emerge. And the nature of counterclockwise motion in this super universe space level determined the direction of the whirl of this thing. Visualize, maybe, I don't know how many there are, but they have to be at least two. Visualize one associate force organizer moving above this card table and another one moving below it. And the counterclockwise basic nature of all motion would determine that it would then start spinning in the plane of the card table counterclockwise.
That's easy to see if you've ever done it in a tub of water by moving a stick up and down, you'll form a thing around.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Coriolis force does it here, though.
Yeah. That's the spin of the Earth that does it. These force organizers are now taking the puissant energy which was produced by the active function of their senior colleagues, and they are transmuting it into gravity energy, or energy responsive to the pull of paradise gravity and ultimately to the pull of linear gravity.
Would you call that gravita?
That is not. That is gravity energy. It is the second form of emergent energy. And the two together are called ultimata.
Oh, we're way back there.
We are building automatons at this point.
But all this is under emerging energy, right?
These are the two steps in emerging energy. Emerging energy, emergent energies, have two phases because there are two phases of force organizers. And the preceding energy, segregata, the force organizers couldn't come out here, the primaries, couldn't come out here and dislodge this from the grasp of the unqualified absolute. All they can do is come out here and take action based on what the conjoint actor has already done. Their function prior to the level of emergent energy is passive. But on segregata, they can now begin to work actively. And when the primaries have done their job, they have produced the A form of emergent energy, which is called puissant energy. And this is something which is discoverable by an associate force organizer. And when he discovers this, he knows he can go to work on energy at that level. And he produces the second form of emergent energy, which is gravity energy. We now have mass appearing, basic mass. This is the ultimatonic stage of energy, because the ultimaton is the smallest unit of mass. Paradise gravity doesn't altogether act on something which is pre-mass, but it will act the instant mass appears. Now, at this point, the story in outer space diverges from the story in the seven super universes. In outer space, I think these associate force organizers go right on fostering the further elaboration of matter, to the electronic level of matter, and to the building up of matter as we know matter. The automaton is not matter as we know it. We have yet to find the automaton. We recognize matter only when 100 automatons aggregate into one of the basic forms of an electron. Then we recognize that this is matter. In outer space, I think these associate force organizers go right on building up matter to the end, to the point where our telescopes will reveal to us nebulae out there, like Andromeda.
Bill, we do know about electrons now that they have this 10 to the minus 7th electrostatic charge, and we're finding out, breaking that down, they're finding out if you start changing chemical reactions, that there is a cohesion that takes place at the tangent to the orbit of the electron, and they call this a neutrino.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read an interesting account of that, and I think they're on the threshold of finding this all of the time.
I think the neutrino is what the papers call a neutron.
No.
It isn't?
They say the neutron is something different.
I get it.
They've called it a neutrino because they've made up this word.
That is different from neutron.
It's different from the neutron.
I get it.
But they say it flies at tangents to the orbital thing, and they give us that about the automaton. But they're getting down to the fact that they say its mass is so much less than that of the smallest
electron.
That they're thinking they're getting into primary mass units.
Uh-huh.
So I think they're going to hit it in a couple of years. They
could be
working on it.
There's more than one kind of an electron, and please don't ask me to explain that. You're out at the periphery of my understanding of nuclear physics. I read nuclear physics years ago in an effort to understand these papers. I can understand that part of nuclear physics which is not mathematical. If they'll say it in English, I can grasp it. I can't follow their formula. And if you've got a guy in here who could explain it to you, you probably couldn't understand him. Since I'm so ignorant, you can understand me.
This Caltech math I told you about, the kindergarten group, when I really went into that chapter, and he seemed to just be really alive with it, but I couldn't understand him.
Yes, I know.
Because he taught technical terms and filled reams of paper.
You've got to talk mathematically at this level, and I can only communicate in English. Let's go back now to Orvantan. These associate transcendental master force organizers worked for 25 billion years. We have that time span given us. They worked for 25 billion years transmuting puissant energy into gravity energy. And then they turned the job over to the power directors of Orvantan. The power directors started to work with automatons. Evidently, the power directors require mass in order to manipulate things. And they can't work until the basic unit of mass has appeared. Then they take over. The rest of the story of this nebula is the story of the supervision of the power centers and power directors of Orvantan. They start with gravity energy, and they elaborate gravita out of gravity energy. Those two names are similar. They can confuse you. Gravita is the technical name for universe power. Gravity energy is the most mature form of emergent energy, or ultimata.
Is a power.
No, it's called universe power. Ruth, you have to remember that mass and energy are interchangeable.
Well,
you follow me?
So
all, yes, all of the mass that we have, that we recognize as matter, we're now down to what we recognize as matter.
Yeah.
This comes under the general heading of universe power, or gravita. I like the name gravita better because it sounds more substantial, like triata in the central universe.
But,
yes.
So gravita is a form of mass as compared to gravity.
Gravita is a name, gravity is not gravity.
No,
however, it designates that level of energy, power, and mass, which does respond to the kind of gravity that we know about.
Linear.
The gravity response of the automaton is to the circular gravity of paradise. And this paradise gravity differs from what we call gravity in two senses. First of all, it's circular in its pull, and second, it is not diminished by the square of the distance traversed. Paradise gravity acts on an automaton in Orvantan, in the first outer space level, or the second outer space level with equal force. Paradise gravity is absolute gravity. Again, let's consider the three universes. The big universe, or macrocosmos, the middle-sized universe that we recognize, the cosmos, and the tiny universe, the microcosmos, the universe of the atom. There are three gravities. Paradise gravity governs the macrocosmos, the big ball of wax. The smaller units in this cosmos, the solar systems, the nebulae, are governed by linear gravity. And linear gravity appears only when you reach electrons and atoms. In the ultimatonic stage, there is no linear gravity. And then, when you do get to atoms, you have tiny gravity, or the tremendously powerful pull of the atomic nucleus, which holds that electron swinging in its orbit. And when you think of an atom, I wish you'd think of our solar system. Our solar system is an atom is a cosmic atom. Just as the whole space level arrangement is the macrocosmic atom. All of these space levels swinging clockwise, counterclockwise around the absolute material nucleus. There are three levels of atoms. There are atoms, solar systems, and the whole big thing.
Within the atom, this drawing power is directly related to paradise?
No, it's directly related to the atomic nucleus.
Only that?
Right.
It's a little independent.
Yes,
system.
It's a third form of gravity.
Okay.
Here, the nucleus is to an electron as the sun is to a planet.
Yeah, if it is independent.
And the gravity of our sun is an almighty power within the confines of the solar system.
Yeah.
But if you went out very far beyond the solar system, you would find that the gravity of our sun was weakening tremendously. And that's exactly the way it is with the drawing power of the nucleus. As you get out to the outermost possible orbits of the electrons, it begins to fumble. And that's why you have radioactive matter in the heavier elements. The last 10 electronic circuits are not too well governed by the atomic nucleus. And that's why atoms fly off in uranium and thorium. They're trans-Pluto and trans-trans-Pluto planets. And any nearby passing body could pull them out of the sun's grasp. The sun would be holding these planets very feebly. As long as nothing came near, the sun could hold them in leash. But if anything came near, the sun might be apt to lose them, as Angona lost some of its planets when it passed near our solar system. These would have been the outermost planets in the Angona system.
They both have the inverse ratio in distances.
Yes, and the distances in the atom are very tiny.
Yes,
right.
Like
I'm sure that we're just starting this, but I'm sure this is the most helpful concept that the average mind can entertain. An atom is a tiny solar system. And an atom is mostly empty space, just as our solar system is mostly empty space. And when you think of that, then you can see why a spirit being can pass through matter. This matter is mostly empty space. If we can send rockets up in the solar system, we're dealing with the porousness of the solar system. And matter is a very porous thing. This is the physicist's concept of matter in contrast to the practical concept of matter, which is very solid.
Air is a good example, Bill.
Yeah.
To lift an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still push your hand through it all the time.
That's right. That's right. Yes, Helene.
Well, the solar system gravity, would that become physics?
That's linear gravity.
Linear, but not
physics. Here, let's get our names straight. Circular gravity is paradise gravity. It operates independently of time and space. Solar system gravity is what we call gravity. It's what keeps us sitting firmly in our chairs. It's what holds this planet in its orbit around the sun. Linear gravity operates independently of time, but not of space. If you have if you have 100 units of gravity, that's a pull, and you go out 2 units of space, you will then have only, what is it? Would be divided, you would then have only 25 units of gravity. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
Gravity. Let's straighten out our thinking. Gravity is what gives mass weight. We speak of a pound of weight. And we think that is a measure of mass. We say, how much have we got here? I've got a pound. That is not a measure of mass. That is a measure of the gravity action on that mass. And since to all practical intents and purposes, the only gravity we deal with is the gravity of the Earth, we use this interchangeably. But if we would take this mass to Jupiter, we would find it weighed much more than a pound, because the gravity of Jupiter is a great deal greater than the gravity of the Earth. Now, there is a word which can be used to describe that mass independently of gravity. This word is poundel. It's a term in physics. Poundel designates a unit of mass regardless of the gravity field. It's defined as that which weighs 1 pound at a certain place on Earth, because the weight of a poundel of mass will vary slightly depending where you weigh it on the face of the Earth. The Earth is not a perfect sphere, and the weight of something varies a little bit as between a measurement taken at the pole and a measurement taken at the equator. Your spring scale will differ a little. The difference is so small that we can ignore it. But there is a difference.
If you bought gold here and took it to the equator enough times, you'd make quite a profit.
Yeah.
At the same, you would.
Yeah. Things weigh a little differently at different places on the Earth.
I've been thinking of going into business.
How about going up to Jupiter with it?
Yeah.
Weigh a lot.
I think
there's a market.
There's no market up there. But it'd be real fun to sell it based on the theoretical weight of Jupiter. We now have in the, let's tell the story of our nebula. We can name it then. We now have the Andromeda Nebula, which is becoming real in terms of the intelligences of Orvantan. In other words, we've got a very upsetting thing taking place out here in space. We have new linear gravity appearing. And this changes the whole equilibrium of surrounding material creations. It's upsetting. Just as it's upsetting when you're in an elevator and it starts up or it starts down, it changes your equilibrium, doesn't it? Or if you're in an airplane and they go this way, you know, your equilibrium has been changed. Or what's even worse, you're trying to sit still on the chair and I'm reaching over pulling you. I'm pulling you off the chair. I'm pulling you out of orbit because a new pull that never existed before is suddenly being felt by all surrounding material creations. And now you see how important it is that this gravity that we talk about diminish as the square of the distance. If it didn't fall down as it passes through space, a new creation would disrupt everything. But as it is, while these surrounding space bodies and physical systems feel this new system, they don't feel it too badly. However, let's read what it says here. We're over here on page 652. By the time the Ervantan power directors had been at work 100 billion years, it says it was necessary to dispatch additional physical controllers to 9 surrounding material creations to afford support and supply cooperation to the power centers of this new material system which was so rapidly evolving. They put up some flying buttresses in the nine nearest physical systems to try to keep this new system from having too disruptive an influence. You see, linear gravity is a property of mass at the atomic and electronic level. And this property appears and it produces a cohesive force. This is what holds our Earth together. If our Earth didn't have this property, then as it spins, it would throw off continents, mountain ranges, seas into space. But the force of our gravity of this planet is much stronger than the outgoing centrifugal force of the spin. More and more automatons are huddling into electrons. More and more super electronic aggregations are forming nucleuses of atoms and are swinging electrons into orbit by virtue of their superior pull. We are now witnessing the beginning of the great struggle between the centripetal or in-pulling force of linear gravity and the centrifugal or outgoing force of heat motion. This is the titanic tug of war. Can the nebula, as it grows, pull all things into itself? Or will orbital revolution, the spin, which was initiated way back when, will it win? This is the first great contention between heat motion and gravity control. Remember, heat and motion are two words which basically describe the same thing. All right.
You didn't get your term heat motion until you repeated it.
Right. Heat motion, put it this way, Ruth. Again, let's keep this real simple. If I take water and heat it, we're working at the molecular level now, which is just a couple, it's just 3 atoms hooked together as an operating unit. The 3 atoms got married and in the case of 2 of them, it's incestuous. It's either incestuous or polygamous, I don't know which. I hope that the hydrogens are related to the oxygen and not to each other. If you heat this water, the measure of heat, as the heat goes up in the water, as you start from, let's say, room temperature or 20 degrees centigrade, and as your centigrade thermometer goes up, well, we're going to Fahrenheit. As you start in room temperature, what is the boiling point? 212
yeah.
Fahrenheit? I live in under Fahrenheit, but all my scientific training was in centigrade, and I'm not used to it. You start at 80 degrees with your water, and you put a thermometer in there, and you pour heat into that water. It's sitting over a gas flame. As that thermometer goes up, you say the water's getting hotter. I can say just as factually, those molecules are moving faster. And we will both agree when we hit the boiling point, because now the molecules are moving so fast that they can escape from the water and move up into the air. Heat is a measure of motion, and motion is a measure of heat.
Are they moving against each other?
Yeah, they're sliding. They're sliding.
Yeah.
In solid matter, the atoms or molecules are locked into a crystalline formation
yeah.
or a cellular formation. In liquid matter, they slide. In gaseous matter, they bounce around like independent tennis balls. But in order to do that, they got to move faster. Right.
Slide is terribly fast.
Yes, yes. For liquid water to become water vapor, these molecules have got to attain the velocity of escape, just like we have to have the velocity of escape in a rocket. Gee, you know, my old professor of physics would be proud of me. I've forgotten all the formula, but I remember some of these principles. Yes, Helene.
Go back now to the very beginning where we've got the table spinning there.
Yes.
And the nebula
yes.
shape. Well, now the heat motion is where it's going around like a top.
Yes.
And then the ones up on top.
No, they aren't there anymore. They've gone away.
Well, what put that sun, the energy, gravity in there?
All right. Here's what's happening, Helene. Two things are happening at the same time. Every time 100 ultramatons aggregate, a little bit of linear gravity is born because an electron has mass, and it has mass in terms of linear gravity.
What causes the huddling?
It's the nature of the electron, the constitution of matter. Electrons tend to huddle. I mean ultramatons.
Yeah.
This is the way the architects of the master universe designed matter. They designed it with these properties. I know they designed it because it refers to the superfinite wisdom which designed material units which are at the one time so flexible and on the other hand so stable. I think the architects worked out the design of matter. Every time these ultramatons huddle, we get some form of an electron. Just exactly how electrons and ultramatons huddle to produce an atomic nucleus, which is to an electron as the sun is to, as our sun is to this planet, I don't know, and the papers don't say. But we know that all of this mass goes back to the ultramatons. Every time an atomic nucleus is born and grabs, let's say, one electron, we've got hydrogen, we have the birth of a little more linear gravity. As this nebula gets more massive, gravity becomes more powerful. It can pull things into it more strongly. If our sun somehow could be increased in mass, here's what would happen. Its gravity pull would automatically go up, and our Earth would move in towards the sun, and as it moved in, it would pick up speed until a new equilibrium was reached between the stronger gravity of the sun and the faster orbital revolution of the Earth. That's exactly what happens when an electron moves into different orbits at varying distance from the nucleus. And these are, I think, quantum jumps of energy. If our sun should diminish in gravity, I think we would move outward towards Mars. And as we moved outward, we would lose speed until our slowed down orbital revolution again hit a balance. If we could speed up the revolution of this earth fast enough, let's say we attach a bunch of jets to it, we could escape from the solar system by going faster and faster against a constant gravity pull or a diminishing gravity pull. All right. Let's go back to our real primitive concept. To all outward intents and purposes, nothing is becoming something. We cannot see water vapor. We can see clouds. It's the same thing, only now we're aware that there's moisture up in the air. We normally, except in fog, don't feel clouds. But when it rains, we feel the rain. This is a more tangible substance. And when that rain freezes, we've got something just as massive as a brick, just as hard, right? We got ice. This is what is seemingly taking place in this nebula. Water vapor is becoming liquefied and then solidifying. And this is all a crude analogy as to what happens as these ultimatons, water vapor, its mass in relation to paradise, but it's not mass in relation to anything else except another ultimaton. Like the lady in the zoo who asked the keeper, what is the sex of this hippopotamus? And he says, my good woman, of what possible interest would that be except another hippopotamus? These ultimatons are interested only in other ultimatons. Now, as our water vapor becomes liquid and then becomes ice, every time we have condensation, we have more gravity. This nebula, the heart of the nebula is becoming stronger in gravity as it becomes massive, as energy is converted into mass, so that there's a tendency to pull in stronger. At the same time, the revolution of matter is speeding up. So now you can begin to sense the titanic tug of war between the cohesive centripetal in-pulling forces of gravity and the outward centrifugal motions of speed in orbit. And please remember, heat and motion are the same thing. When something moves faster, we call it getting hotter. That is our sensory name for an increase in velocity.
In all cases,
there is no difference between heat and motion.
I've got to think about
that. All right, let's take heat away from water vapor and see what happens. It slows down and rains.
Fire.
Let's take heat away from water and we slow molecular velocity down until it crystallizes.
I just have to use those terms.
Yes. Men observed motion and men observed heat. And not knowing the connection between the two, our language has two words for the same phenomena. Some things are observable to us as motion. Other changes are observable to us as heat. Practically speaking, we need two words. They're united in the concept of hot rod, something which moves fast. But otherwise, they don't conjoin. The physicist thinks of these two phenomena as one and the same thing. Practically speaking, Bob doesn't hop into Los Angeles. He moves. Practically speaking, we don't increase the motion of molecules in water when we percolate coffee. We heat the coffee. It's the difference between realizing that this table is mostly empty space, and to all, at the same time, to all practical intents and purposes, just as solid and dependable as anything.
But when I walk, where's the heat? Of course, if I walk long enough, I heat up.
Yes, there's some heat. You are burning energy. In order to move, you must draw upon what we call heat.
Work
and that
energy.
Is That is stored energy.
Yeah, work and energy.
This is the sugar in your bloodstream, which is being oxidized, giving off heat, which supplies the energy that we call muscular motion. We're burning fuel. We have a carburetor system, which we call lungs. We got to get something that will support combustion right into that bloodstream. And that's the function of the hemoglobin, or the iron molecules in the red blood, which go up to the lungs, pick up oxygen, they rust and turn red, just like iron does when it turns red. This rusty blood is very valuable because it's carrying oxygen. It carries oxygen into the tissues where there's sugar. And we oxidize that sugar and produce waste materials and carbon dioxide. We breathe out carbon dioxide. This is the smoke of the fire. Always remember, there's no difference between rotting, rusting, burning, and exploding. They're all the same thing. It's just a matter of time. Rusting and rotting is an oxidizing process that takes a long time. In burning, we oxidize faster. In exploding, we oxidize fastest. Are you with me?
Yes.
See, what we're trying to do is to clean up our semantics so that we can go from practical language to precise language.
Categorizing what's not the big broad types of energy, is this still emergent?
No, we're out of emergent.
We
are now in gravita energy.
Well, I thought that was a form.
No, this is a category. This is a category covering. It does not cover automatons. It does cover atoms, electrons, nuclei, gamma waves, beta waves, X-rays, magnetism, chemism. It covers every single thing that we learned about in physics and chemistry. This is the domain of gravita, otherwise known as universe power.
Universe power.
Right. Linear gravity.
We can't say that's physical, not gravity, but physical matter.
This is physical matter?
As we know it.
This is everything that we know about physical things or physical energies. This is electricity. This is light, sunlight. This is infrared. This is ultraviolet. This is the whole physical universe as we know it. We know nothing of the physical universe before this stage, and Havona is too far away for us to know of any other kind of physical universe.
Well, where is the line that changes from emergent type of energy to universe power type of energy?
It is when automatons become electrons.
Oh, thanks.
There is the critical change. Automatons attract each other, but that's not linear gravity. But an electron has linear gravity of an infinitesimal sort. And when you build electrons into atoms, now you're building something that we can see. When you get enough of them, you've got a brick. And if you have enough bricks, you've got a planet. You follow me? And while we don't sense gravity in the brick, we sense it when we get enough of them to have a planet. Or even a planetoid. If you could land on an asteroid, a little chunk of rock, let's say, make it 100 cubic miles. That isn't very big. That is much bigger than cubic Los Angeles, right? You would adhere to the surface of that little rock if you were there in a spacesuit. But if you jumped, you might jump all the way out into space. You might not come back. Gravity for a field would be so feeble. Conversely, if Bud's home could be transported to Jupiter, assuming that the atmosphere could be clean, we'll seal it. When we went on Jupiter, the gravity field would be so strong, we would be pulled downward so badly that we would run all over the floor like pancake batter. We would be instantly killed by Jupiter's gravity. If we were on the moon and the moon had air, this would be an interesting experience. We would be tremendously strong because our muscles would be used to an Earth's gravity field. And on the moon, I suppose we could jump 50 feet into the air. we could pick up this piano without any trouble at all. It wouldn't weigh as much as a weigh about like a dispatch case. You follow me?
We wouldn't be any taller, though.
No, we'd be the same size, but we'd weigh less.
Everybody could always carry their bride over the threshold.
Yes. We would weigh on the moon, I suppose, about 25 or 30 pounds, an average-sized human. Now, since he has muscles that are used to propelling, let's say, 150 pounds, he would seemingly be three times as strong. You would have an awful time walking on the moon because your muscles are trained to put a thrust that will move 150 pounds. And since you're only moving, let's say, 50 pounds, you would kangaroo. You'd have to shuffle and learn to walk all over again.
Sort of like walking under the water.
Yes. You would have the same mass, but your weight would change because you're in a weaker gravity field.
The difference in gravity is proportion to the mass?
Yes, that's right.
And all of this is graviton.
All of this is covered under the general heading of graviton.
Yes.
When they speculate about the size of people on different planets, they say if the gravity pull is such and such, the person would be real tall and
yes.
big. And why do they do that?
Because of this, there is a relationship of strength and size. An insect is inconceivably stronger than a human being. Insects can move things that are much bigger than they are. In a larger planet, let's say a planet twice our size, Jupiter's out. It's much too big for life as we know it. But let's say we've got a planet that is twice as massive as Earth. I've forgotten the ratio. Would it have twice the gravity or four times the gravity? Let's say it's twice the gravity, and that may be wrong. It would be pretty hard to build people who could move, say, 300 pounds. That's a pretty heavy guy. Consider how sluggish a 300-pounder is here on Earth. So, let's make the people smaller. Let's make 75-pound people. We'll have them. A real tall guy will be 4 feet tall. This is a tall guy. And we can, by reducing mass, we can enable him to function efficiently and agilely in this stronger gravity field. Conversely, on Mars, we want a bigger person because the gravity field is weaker. There, on the moon, a 300-pounder would only weigh 100 pounds. He could move around. The size of the person varies oppositely with the size of the planet.
While we're touching on this, explain the Adamites' amazing height.
They were strong. They were real strong people.
Supermen.
Right. And they didn't stay that tall.
How about these Watusi tribesmen in Africa?
Well, you had two strains of giantism appear in the evolutionary peoples. Both the orange and the green people developed strains of giantism.
And
Goliath is a hangover from that.
And these could possibly be orange or green?
Yes.
Their coloring isn't the same.
No, but the strain might be there.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that everybody has to be the same height, but it means that a person of 8 or 10 feet height may be nearing the limit of human efficiency here. Don't forget also Adam and Eve probably had a muscle structure that went considerably beyond ours. What was he, 8 feet in height?
Yeah, 8 feet.
That's about as tall as they've come.
Were the corporeal people, they don't mention their height.
I would guess that they were in proportion to the
Andonites,
yeah, they're going to work together. So, can we go back to the spin?
Yes.
Do you have a mental picture now of two contending forces, each of which are growing? Mass continues to be born in the nebula. And every time mass is born, gravity appears. At the same time, it spins faster. And that means a force, which is the opposite of gravity, is fighting this gravity. Our Earth is stable in its orbits only because these two contending forces are exactly in equilibrium. We got two groups of men in a tug of war, and we've shifted our sides until we have got exactly the same muscle power on both ends of the rope. The net effect is a stationary rope, right? But that doesn't mean that they're not tugging as hard as they can tug. The sun, with all its might, is trying to pull this earth into itself. And this earth, with all its might, is trying to escape from the pull of the sun. And the two forces are exactly equal.
Centripetal, and if they, centrifugal.
Centrifugal and centripetal. Yes?
Would the idea of falling stars come in here, suns that have stopped the...
A falling star is not really a star. It's a meteor. It's a big chunk of rock. And when it hits our atmosphere, it heats up because it's moving fast through something. And as it heats up, it may start to burn. And when it starts to burn, then we see it. And that's why, usually, it vanishes before it hits. It's actually burned out. Our atmosphere is a big protective cushion, which keeps us from being killed by meteors. It burns them up before they hit the ground. It takes an awful big one to get through.
With a lot of iron, so they get protective carbon.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Now, let's read a little bit from the text, and I think it'll mean more. $600 billion years ago,
where are
you? I'm on page 652.
Right. Wow.
The 600 billion years ago, the power directors had been working here for 200 billion years. And this was the height of the Andromeda energy mobilization. The nebula had acquired its maximum of mass. At this time, it was a gigantic circular gas cloud. I think our water vapor story is pretty good. We've now got to the cloud stage. When the power director started, you couldn't see anything out here. It was water vapor. Now we've got to the cloud stage.
It's a gas
cloud, yes. Probably containing more hydrogen than anything else, because hydrogen is the most primitive element. It's the simplest element. One proton, one neutron. Yes, Ruth?
When it attained its maximum of mass, that yes. means it had used up all the potential of a particular chunk of space potency that was here?
Just about, yes. But not mature mass.
No.
Probably a very high percentage of this mass was hydrogen gas.
Yes.
Now, more complex elements are beginning to be elaborated out of simpler elements and shattered atoms and all kinds of things. At this time, it was a gigantic circular gas cloud in shape somewhat like a flattened spheroid. You know, that's the shape of the Earth. That's the shape of paradise. This was the early period of differential mass formation and varying revolutionary velocity. Gravity and other influences were about to begin their work of converting space gases into organized matter. At this time, I can see only the lighter elements present. Hydrogen, lithium, oxygen, in gaseous form. Lithium we think of as a solid, but a lithium atom might exist freely in open space at this stage. Yeah, you get some pictures, but that's good.
I got one of the Magellan Cloud, which I thought.
This enormous nebula now began gradually to assume the spiral form and to become clearly visible to the astronomers of even distant universes. We have now reached a nebula which is like a nebula that we can see.
And most of this checks now with our knowledge on Earth.
They don't know what happens before a nebula comes out. Yeah. You show them, bud.
Well, this is...
What's that, the Magellan Cloud?
The Orion Nebula.
Yeah.
But it's similar looking.
Have you got a picture of a good spiral there?
Yeah. Excellent picture.
Yeah, there's a beach.
Andromeda.
No, here's one, too.
Here's, can you see this?
There's another one, but...
Yeah.
We made this a stereo farm at school, you know, on great big black.
The reason for the spiral appearance is because things are swinging out, and then different orbits separate them. And when they come back in, they converge again, and they become more visible. Actually, each of these spiral arms goes on out and then swings back into another spiral. And it's the cone effect of divergence and convergence. We see the base of the cone, but then we lose it as it becomes too diffuse out here. So that apparently that arm vanishes. It doesn't vanish. It merely vanishes to vision. It's too diffuse to be seen.
Well, do the particles that are so far apart, do they get lost in space?
No, they're held by the pull of the central, more massive core.
They are circulating. Yes, they are. They're so far apart that we don't see until they come back and congeal.
Here, think of a lot of comets going around the sun with a big orbit. This is the history of most nebulae. They are observed as a spiral phenomena before they begin to throw off suns. The nearby star students of that faraway era, as they observed these changes in the Andromeda Nebula, saw exactly what 20th century astronomers see when they turn their telescopes spaceward and view the present age spiral nebula of adjacent outer space. So that a good deal of what went on prior to this point would not be visible to us. It's not only the force organizers, but even the power directors. Their early functions would represent something which we would have great difficulty in detecting. They've been out here roughly 200 billion years before the results of their work become visible. About the time of the attainment of the maximum of mass, the gravity control of the gaseous content commenced to weaken, and there ensued the stage of gas escapement, the gas streaming forth as two gigantic and distinct arms which took origin on opposite sides of the mother mass. The rapid revolutions of this enormous central core soon imparted a spiral appearance to these two projecting gas streams. The cooling and subsequent condensation. Now, when they say cooling, that merely means the slowing down of motion. The cooling and subsequent condensation of portions of these protruding arms eventually produced their knotted appearance. Or subnebular gravity centers are beginning to appear here. These denser portions were vast systems and subsystems of physical matter, whirling through space in the midst of the gaseous cloud of the nebula, while being held securely within the gravity grasp of the mother wheel. But the nebula had begun to contract, which means gravity now is getting a little stronger grip on the core. Every time heat motion wins a little bit in the victory, gravity is a little stronger in that area. It gets as it gives. But the nebula had begun to contract, and the increase in the rate of revolution further lessened gravity control. And ere long, the outer gaseous regions began actually to escape from the immediate embrace of the nebular nucleus, passing out into space on circuits of irregular outline, returning to the nuclear regions to complete their circuits, and so on. Now, they didn't escape from the control of the nebula. They escaped from being a part of the central core, in the same way that our Earth has escaped from the confines of the sun, but not from the control of the sun. Do you follow me? Mm-hmm. But this was only a temporary stage of nebular progression. The ever-increasing rate of whirling was soon to throw enormous suns off into space on independent circuits. And this is what happened in Andromeda ages upon ages ago. The energy wheel grew and grew until it attained its maximum of expansion. And then, when contraction set in, it whirled on faster and faster until eventually the critical centrifugal stage was reached and the great breakup began. 500 billion years ago, the first Andromeda sun was born. This blazing streak broke away from the mother gravity grasp and tore out into space on an independent adventure in the cosmos of creation. Its orbit was determined by its path of escape. Such young suns quickly become spherical and start out on their long and eventful careers as the stars of space. Excepting terminal nebular nucleuses, the vast majority of Orvantan suns have had an analogous birth. These escaping suns pass through varied periods of evolution and subsequent universe service. In other words, this sun is a concrete chunk of the nebula. It is a sun because it is bordered for the first time by relatively empty space. It is an independent fragment of the nebula, still revolving around the nebular circuit, but it is going to be a sun. 400 billion years ago began the recaptive period of the Andromeda Nebula. Many of the nearby and smaller suns were recaptured as a result of the gradual enlargement and further condensation of the mother nucleus. Very soon there was inaugurated the terminal phase of nebular condensation, the period which always precedes the final segregation of these immense space aggregations of energy and matter. And this is when Michael came out here. It was scarcely a million years subsequent to this epoch that Michael of Nebadon, a creator son of paradise, selected this disintegrating nebula as the site of his adventure in universe building. Almost immediately, the architectural worlds of Salvington and the 100 constellation headquarters groups of planets were begun. It required almost 1 million years to complete these clusters of specially created worlds. The local system headquarters planets were constructed over a period extending from that time to about 5 billion years ago.
By whom were they constructed?
The power centers of Orvanta. No. These architectural worlds are built by the universe power directors. These universe power directors can set atoms as a printer sets type. And I think they start with the core of this architectural world and they work outward, building around this core. I think Salvington was originally smaller than a tennis ball. As they began to put these atoms together, produce the first little tiny speck of matter, and then build on it.
And they did it from Universal?
No, they did it right out here, working directly on it. And to me, the easiest way to look at this is to say, just like a printer has a font of type, so these power centers have got the dust of space to work with. Yeah. And they reach out, let's see, we need some vowels now. So they go into the A box and they set a few A's. And little by little, they build this out. It took them 1 million years to build Salvington. It takes a long time.
Considering all this.
That's right. Yes,
now, Salvington is a sphere. It isn't like paradise. It isn't the...
Salvington is a round globe. Probably a little flattened like our Earth. And it's made out of the same material that our Earth is made. Except, I think, they've used fewer of the heavy elements. Otherwise, the gravity would be too rough. I think the gravity on Salvington is much less than, let's say, the gravity of Jupiter. But Salvington might be as big as Jupiter.
Yeah, they don't have this kind of flesh and blood matter to
no,
deal with.
No, but they have oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, calcium, on Salvington. The basic core of the physical sphere of Salvington is made out of exactly the same material as is this earth and our sun. Yes.
But as you go further in up toward Avanta and Uversa,
Uversa is made out of the same stuff as this planet.
Oh.
Yes. All architectural spheres are built out of the same physical matter which they have in Arbanta. What else would they build with?
Is that what the term architectural means?
Yes. The term architectural means put together by hand. Yes. Non-evolutionary. That's why there are no storms on these worlds. That's why there are no earthquakes. There is nothing out of balance.
They have no more elements.
The physical sphere has exactly the same elements.
Only 100.
Now,
where are the 200?
I think the Marantia life of a planet is confined to its surface. I think the core of the planet is purely physical. I think the Marantia life is a surface manifestation on the planet.
Is it organic chemistry?
It's organic. Well, on the surface of the planet, they elaborate 100 Marantia materials. But the heart of the planet, I think, is just as physical as your answer. You see, these, when the universe power directors built Salvington, they work only in physical matter, the 100 elements. The second 100 elements, the Marantia elements, would not have been elaborated until the Marantia power supervisors began to operate. The physical power centers do not work with Marantia materials. When they finished with Salvington, they had a raw subdivision. And this raw subdivision was just as physical as it could be. There was nothing Marantia there or nothing spiritual there. Now, later on, when the Marantia power supervisors were created, they added to the surface of the planet that patina of the Marantia life, which is so important because you only live on the surface.
Skin.
Yes. The Marantia material no more penetrates a planet than does organic life penetrate this planet. It's strictly a surface phenomenon. Do you visualize this?
Yes,
yeah.
That helps a lot.
Much easier. I thought it was some substance that we didn't even know about.
Everything in Arbantan, every sphere in Arbantan is made out of these 100 elements.
The power directors, the power centers.
Yes. Later on, when Mike Gill first came to Salvington, this was strictly a physical sphere. And his creative spirit operated as a super power center. Prior to the creation of Gabriel, she worked exclusively in the physical domain. Shall I read you about that?
Yes.
All right, let's read about this. Let's stop here. Let's pause here now and consider. Well, let's read one more. Mike Hill arrived here roughly 400 billion years ago. 300 billion years ago, the Andromeda solar circuits were well established, and the nebular system was passing through a transient period of relative physical stability. About this time, the staff of Mike Hill arrived on Salvington, and the Uversa government of Arvantan extended physical recognition to the local universe of Nebadon. Michael and the creative spirit were working out here with no spiritual staff. They were working as physical builders. Remember, Michael is a son of the Universal Father who is the source of paradise. This creative associate of his is the daughter of the Infinite Spirit, who is the God of action and who physically induced the creation of Havona. There is 100 billion years during which Michael functioned in a totally non-spiritual way. He was a physical builder. During this time, his creative associate was functioning as a super power center. Now let's see what they did. First of all, it's fascinating to arrive at this point and then think about the pre spiritual work of a Creator Son. If you will turn to page 204. Well, we don't get much here. This merely has to do with their departure from paradise.
I think in the paper on the Paradise Creator Sons, isn't it?
There's some stuff in there, yeah. We'll look at that.
The thing about this, you get something in every part of the book.
You sure do. Well, this is like the Paradise Ascent. This cuts through everything.
Because the Nebula story is in book one, too. Also.
Yes.
That's fascinating. As the doctor said, this has a cosmology worthy of God.
Well, let's turn to page 235. We'll pick up the story of Michael. 235. The Paradise Sons of the Primary Order are the designers, creators, builders, and administrators of their respective domains, the local universes of time and space, the basic creative units of the seven evolutionary superuniverses. A Creator Son is permitted to choose the space site of his future cosmic activity, but before he may begin even the physical organization of his universe, he must spend a long period of observation devoted to the study of the efforts of his older brothers and various creations located in the superuniverse of his projected action. And prior to all of this, the Michael Son will have completed his long and unique experience of paradise observation and Havona training. When a Creator Son departs from paradise to embark upon the adventure of universe making, to become the head, virtually the god, of the local universe of his own organization, then for the first time, he finds himself in intimate contact with, and in many respects dependent upon, the third source and center. The infinite spirit, though abiding with the Father and the Son at the center of all things, is destined to function as the actual and effective helper of each Creator Son. Therefore is each Creator Son accompanied by a creative daughter of the infinite spirit, that being who is destined to become the divine minister, the mother spirit, of the new local universe. The departure of a Michael Son on this occasion forever liberates his creator prerogatives from the paradise sources and centers, subject only to certain limitations inherent in the pre-existence of these sources and centers, and to certain other antecedent presences and powers. Among the limitations to the otherwise all-powerful creator prerogatives of a local universe father are the following. 1. Energy matter is dominated by the infinite spirit. Before any new forms of things, great or small, may be created, before any new transformations of energy matter may be attempted, a Creator Son must secure the consent and working cooperation of the infinite spirit. 2. Creature designs and types are controlled by the Eternal Son. Before a Creator Son may engage in the creation of any new type of being, any new design of creature, he must secure the consent of the Eternal and Original Mother Son. 3. Personality is designed and bestowed by the Universal Father. You can't do anything about that.